everybody, and welcome to the new year. I am joined today by Executive Director of Marketing and Sales at New England Biolabs, long-term friend of Covalent Bonds, Andy Butera. Andy, thank you so much for joining us today.
My absolute pleasure, Laura. Great to be chatting with you.
Oh, I'm so pleased to get you on because I know that you've got so much experience in history that our listeners could benefit from. So I'm really excited about this conversation.
Yeah, no, definitely looking forward to it.
So what I'd really like to know, Andy, is just to dig a little bit into your journey to your current role. How did you get into scientific marketing? What is your background? Can you tell us a little bit of your history?
Yeah, happy to. So I'm a microbiologist by background. I went to King's College in London to study microbiology. And at the end of my sort of bachelor's degree, I was in the lucky position of having a couple of PhD projects opportunities in front of me, plus two job opportunities. And the one job was actually an R&D research scientist at a company called Amersham, also in the UK. And they convinced me that I didn't need a PhD to move into that role. So I thought, okay, I'll give it a go. And if it doesn't turn out, I'll go back and do a PhD the year after. And I found that I really loved the whole aspect of commercial research and developing products. What I found through that, it was actually not so much the benchwork that I found intriguing, but the actual whole process of developing a product and then putting it on the market and having people obviously buy that product. That really sort of led me into the world of marketing and product management specifically. My route from sort of science to marketing was really through the commercialization and development of new products.
Did you find it hard to make that transition into marketing from your scientific background?
No, I was really lucky, to be honest with you. I was at one of Amersham's facilities in Cardiff, Wales, not too far away from where I was born. I was actually the only marketing person in the entire facility. So I would put a lab coat on every day. I would actually go into my office and you know, do all the good things that I was learning to do as a product marketing specialist. And if I had a question that I couldn't answer from a technical perspective, I literally could open my door and shout it across the lab and said, "Can anybody answer this question?" So it was great, actually, to have that transition from a scientist to marketing in that environment. Now, to be honest, being on my own, I obviously had to learn a little bit the hard way on my own. So certainly when I had the opportunity to work at other sites and interact with other marketing people as the organization grew, I certainly preferred that. But the transition was actually made easier because of that that sort of strange circumstance I found myself.
As a sole marketer, did you find that marketing was treated with some skepticism, or with you being a scientist with your background, was it more accepted?
That's a great question. I've always found that you know, marketing is a blend of art and science. I think the science piece of it, particularly having a scientific background, enabled me to sort of think about how I communicated with scientists with their sort of thought patterns and ways of working in mind. Not really. I mean, I think it was, you know, the key was, to be honest with you, was always to bring data to the discussion. So if you said, I don't know, there was a specific specification or something that was required for a product, the question was asked is, can you prove that to the scientist that this this specification is the right one? So bringing market research data, you know, bringing voice of customer into those sort of meetings and discussions was key. And obviously not just one customer, but multiple in that. So you really could justify the data you were putting before them.
I love that. I love that. Now, obviously, as a scientist, that comes naturally to you. Now that you've got multiple teams of marketing and comms professionals, first of all, are the people that you hire mainly marketing by background or scientists?
Varies by role. I would say that the product marketing staff, without fault, have a scientific background. In areas like marketing communications or certain aspects of digital marketing, I think having a specialization and a deeper knowledge in those type of backgrounds works equally well. Going back to the product marketing, I think it's easier to train a scientist to do marketing than it is to train a marketer to be a scientist, let's say.
That's an interesting observation because we come across that quite a lot. And on that vein, are you finding that the marketers by background are less accepting of using the sort of data-driven approach versus the scientists who it might be more natural to?
Good question. I think it, again, varies on the role. I mean, if somebody's a graphic designer, then they're obviously, they're interested in the science, but it's how they can then visualize that science and communicate it to a scientist. So the data aspect is maybe less important to there than it is the sort of more qualitative aspects that they're trying to actually develop as part of their role. If you're in digital marketing, however, you know, it's a very different world, and that data is what they live and breathe every day.
You mentioned there about graphic designers need to understand who they're trying to sell to effectively communicate with them. Mm-hmm. How do you use data to inform that kind of discussion, and how do you ensure that your team have that front of mind?
I mean, maybe some examples might sort of help the sort of dialogue. I remember launching a particular product many years ago, and the scientist who was actually responsible for developing the product, you know, was very passionate about their product and obviously wanted to be successful in the marketplace. And one of the discussion points that came up was pricing, you know, and as you can imagine, if you develop a product, then if you're passionate about it, you want to obviously see the greatest return on that. So the individual had a great belief that the price of this product should be quite significant. So I went through an exercise, I'm sure a number of your listeners are aware of, called value mapping, where you actually look at the different values and benefits that a product brings. You prioritize them, and then you sort of compare the values or the benefits that product has with the competition, and then sort of develop a graph, if you like, of comparing those benefits against the different prices the competitors have. We had a line on the graph which predicted what price or price range we should be selling this product at. And the scientist was blown away by this. He was quite enamored by the fact we were using data to as part of marketing and highlighting that sort of its importance in that regard. He accepted the pricing range that we come up with. Although I should say the following day, he did come back to me with, I think, five different lines of best fit across the data that we were presenting that varied it by a few pennies per reaction. But he was, he'd have the last word, I guess, in that regard. So may not answer your specific question around marketers, but it's a nice example on the data and connecting with individuals using it.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that. So one of the themes of this podcast is how to learn from failure. And obviously, if you're doing a data-driven approach, one of the key things is monitoring how effective something is and then optimizing based on that data. And obviously, in some of those cases, you're going to see it doesn't work. So how do you bring a culture of learning from failure into your marketing team?
Great question. Firstly, I would say that failure is definitely acceptable. I try to sort of develop a theme within the team that I work for that it's fine to actually fail. In fact, if you're not failing enough, you're probably not experimenting enough, which I think marketing is a great venue, particularly digital marketing, where you can actually fail, you know, learn from it, and then improve whatever you're doing the next time around.
Yes.
The key is to learn from it, of course. And if you fail doing it, my only ask to the team is don't repeat exactly the same thing and expect different results, because you're going to fail again. So learn from it and then sort of move on to, you know, that. It comes back a little bit to our sort of discussion around science and marketing that, you know, obviously a large part of science is carrying out experiments. And experiments are obviously trying to prove one thing or another. And we hope that, you know, through that one thing or another, you see success or failure and you learn and you move on to modify that experiment or do the thing differently. So experimentation, to me, is a key part of marketing today.
Is that the same at a senior level? So I'll give you an example. I know some larger companies in our space that marketing is seen still as a bit of a, I hate to say it, but a bit of a budget drain, because there hasn't been that clarity. And therefore, there has been a drive to watch what competitors are doing and just do what the competitors do, rather than being experimental, like you've described. Is there a culture of experiment and taking risk in marketing within New England Biolabs?
I believe so, and I think it's probably broader than just marketing. We're fortunate, to be honest, we're private, not public, so that helps us to have maybe a little bit more flexibility and not have the sort of, you know, watchful finance eye on us all the time. I think that the real challenge, to be honest, with marketing is that there are a huge number of things you can measure, and there are some mm-hmm. things that are more difficult to measure. That doesn't mean you shouldn't measure them. You just need to think about them in or measure them in different ways. So, you know, if you're carrying out an email campaign, just as an example, obviously there's plenty of statistics that you can apply to that. You know, things mm-hmm. that your listeners know, open rates, close rates, you know, what's the most successful email for a certain time of day or day of the week or subject lines, and the list goes on. There's all kinds of variables you can test and experiment with. If you're trying mm-hmm. to actually measure the value of your brand, however, at a much higher level or perhaps awareness of a brand, that's much more difficult to do, you know, and although there are some very good methods to give you indications, they're not as easy as that email blast where you can see a very discrete and specific feedback. And you have to measure things at different levels. The sort of statistics I use for an email blast are not the sort of things you should use for, you know, awareness for a brand, where you have mm-hmm. to use softer sort of feedback and more indications that you're combining together that that awareness is there.
So how about things like offline, like going to an event, for example? How would you approach measuring that at NEB?
It's like at a trade show sort of thing?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, as everybody does, you count the number of contacts, the number of leads and inverted commas that you sort of are making at that that event. Mm-hmm. For our trade shows, we try to divide the leads into different sort of levels of importance, let's say, you know, ones that where customers got an immediate need, they're interested in a product and you need to send them a sample. Obviously, that's a very important action you need to take with your sales organization to get them that sample mm-hmm. and then follow up. And that one, very often, there's a closed loop there, because if the customer tests the sample, they like it, then obviously you've got a sale you can measure against that. You've mm-hmm. got obviously then much softer ones where somebody just comes by and says, who's doing the BioLabs, you know, and, you know, you connect with them, you sort of give them that information. They may want a brochure, they may want a catalog if they're still into print literature. And those, you know, you're adding a contact to your database, your CRM, mm-hmm. But the return there is likely much longer. And that one, to be honest, is hard to measure because it disappears into the ethos. So, you know, over the years, I think our trade show attendance is focused on smaller shows rather than larger shows, where you've got yep. a more discrete product offering where you can measure those sorts of returns. The larger shows are still important for brand awareness, but they're the harder ones to sort of measure. And sometimes we have to look at those and say, you know, those I'm combining with my more awareness tactics. It could be, you know, print advertising, it could be banner advertising, where we're talking about corporate awareness, where it's almost, we have to submit a portion of our budget for those activities to make sure that our name is still being realized and people recall us, you know, and it's harder mm-hmm. to get that immediate return.
So you started to talk there about sort of first touch points in marketing, which might be mm-hmm. the brand awareness at a conference versus somebody who has a sale and it could be the last touch point. Do you have a marketing attribution model that you guys always use to measure across the buying cycle?
I'll be honest with you and say no. We've looked at many different models and never found one that's a perfect fit for us. We certainly know, certainly selling in academia, which is a large part of our business, we have mm-hmm. known attribution gaps at certain institutions. So as an example, you know, we'll have a scientist at the bench, you know, they could be on our website. We can track that. They could be opening mm-hmm. emails. We can track that. They could be interacting with a salesperson. We can track that. They could want a sample, to use the example I gave earlier, of a product. We can track that. We'll even get feedback from them saying the sample was great, but then somebody else in that organization may place the order. It could be, you know, a procurement agent in purchasing. It could be a lab manager. And sometimes, yeah. particularly if it's a procurement agent, that procurement agent is dealing with, you know, hundreds or more scientists. So then there's a break. We know that somebody in that academic institute or that university purchased the product, but we got this gap to say that sale goes back to that person who sampled the product, that person who went on the website, et cetera, et cetera. So mm-hmm. that break in that sort of closed loop, if you like, is where we have challenges with getting full attribution of all those marketing activities against that individual sale. However, yeah. if you scale it up, we can measure all of those email, all of those website touch points, all of those samples that have gone out, and all of the sales of that product, particularly if it's a new product. And then you can, at least at a sort of campaign or higher level of marketing activity, look at the return you're getting on your overall activities rather than, you know, looking at that individual customer.
Or at the account level as well.
Account level, even, yes, good point.
Yeah. A slightly related question. How far is marketing responsible for a lead? Are they responsible right through, because you mentioned attribution, right through to the sale. Is marketing responsible for supporting all the way through to that point, or is it up to just marketing qualified lead?
Great question. I'm always surprised when I see surveys of questions asking marketers whether they carry a sales number or have a sales target to achieve. Mm-hmm. I've never not had one in my career, so I don't know whether I'm lucky or maybe I'm unlucky. I'm not sure, but to me, you know, sales and sales activities, the sales of your product, is a key metric and a key aspect of all marketers' activities, particularly if you're a product marketer, of course. For me, I also believe that sales and marketing need to work at the hip. They need to actually work in tandem to actually see the success of the marketing activities as well as the sales activities. Mm-hmm. And as a consequence of that, I actually don't like the term marketing qualified lead or sales accepted lead, because by using those terms, you're effectively, you know, have a barrier between the two organizations, and you're almost given an excuse for both organizations to say, well, I had a load of qualified leads and the sales field, well, I didn't accept them, you know, or the other way around. Oh. A lead is either good or it's not. Don't add metrics between the two that allow organizations to define them differently.
Wow, that's a big learning. That's a great point. So how do you categorize your leads? How do they progress through the funnel?
I mean, to be honest, this is an area we're trying to improve ourselves at the moment. So I don't have a good answer for that, because it's something we're going to evolve and develop as we become a larger organization. Sales, or the sales organization, you know, was almost the last organization in NEB to be resourced in many, many regards. So as a consequence, our evolution of developing a sales pipeline, developing, you know, how marketing and sales work together has only really been in the last sort of quarter, if you like, of NEB's history. But it definitely is becoming more important going forward. Our average orders are in the hundreds of dollars. So as a consequence, you know, we don't really need a pipeline to measure every single opportunity that comes in. Go back to my example of this customer, this scientist receiving an email and then requesting a sample. You know, the perfect scenario is that that sample works for them and they place an order. And then obviously they repeat that order going forward, and no salesperson was ever involved in that process. And yet the salesperson is going to get the recognition, rightly so, because they're there to support that account and that customer. But there's no handover. It just it goes through the process and you generate sales. NEB's product portfolio, however, has become more complex, as has the different buying channels that exist within the life sciences. So for us, you know, the salespeople, you know, are focusing more on those more complex sales, those more technical products, as well as upselling the organization to enhance the experience that the customer has with the organization by either through ourselves or working with third parties to provide a better buying and support experience, which ultimately is going to be the differentiator long term.
Oh, fabulous. I love that. So the answer might be that you've not done this yet, but do you have a lead scoring model in place?
We don't.
Is that in the pipeline?
Scoring generally, it's been talked about for some time in terms of scoring contacts, scoring customers to look at, you know, how engaged they are, how perhaps loyal they are. And then obviously, you know, within that, leads and where they are in the buying cycle is obviously part of that as well. The buying cycle itself is something we often, you know, discuss and we're trying to get better grips on, particularly for these larger sales. But for us, the amusing thing, the buying cycle is typically the customer goes to the freezer, oh, I've run out of this, I'm going to reorder it. Many of NEB's products have been around for over 40 years, so that buying cycle is as simple as that. But obviously for new products, for new technologies and more complex products, which involve more people to sign off on that purchase, then that isn't the case. And that's really, you know, our sort of next focus of improving this, our understanding of this buying cycle and how we manage and support customers through it.
And it's one of those areas where you really do see the sales and marketing working together, because if the sales aren't informing on what activities actually lead to a sale, the marketer will never know. So that is why I asked that. So,
very good point. One other thing I'd say is, through the pandemic, I'm sure many of your listeners' sales organizations, the sales team was obviously at home, not visiting customers face to face. So they did have a little bit more desk time, let's say, than previous. So it did allow us to explore concepts like account-based marketing or account-based engagement, as we like to call it. And that really did bring sales and marketing together and start our marketing activities at an account level that we hadn't done, certainly at the level we're doing it now.
So how does that work practically? Is it led by the salesperson or is it led by marketing?
In our case, it's led by the salesperson. We believe that they are the best contact to help understand which opportunities, which accounts we might want to target. That said, data becomes a very important part of that, looking at obviously the sales history of that account, the number of email addresses we have in that account, the number of active email users we have that account, etc., which helps to define, you know, whether that account is an opportunity for us to enhance our presence at. The way we actually managed it initially was we had small teams that included sales, marketing, and in our case, the field application scientist organization also were involved, developing tactics and strategies for those individual accounts. And what we did to start, we actually divided up the accounts into different segments. So we needed a large academic account or a small biotech account or whatever it is, and tried different tactics at those types of accounts, and then learned from that, and then could deploy it at scale by having that sort of data of success or failure behind us.
Because I know a lot of companies are thinking about account-based marketing. They know of it as a something they should be doing, but I don't think many people know actually how to do that.
Well, a couple of things we did, we changed it from account-based marketing to account-based engagement, and that was a deliberate decision, and I apologize, somebody should take credit for that name change, which I read somewhere. But again, it was similar to my comment about marketing qualified leads and sales accepted leads. Putting the word marketing almost became anti-sales because it's a marketing activity, right? And I said, well, no, I want it to be about the account, about the customer. So changing that was important. And also, as I said, having the sales team lead it and then own it such that now we have templates, we have different tools we can use that the salesperson can deploy more rapidly and not need this sort of team to sort of develop these tactics because we know certain tactics are going to work better than others.
So what's the split between your account engagement strategies, inbound marketing and outbound marketing? What's the sort of percentage split roughly?
In terms of like the spend and things like that?
No, as in effort. So effort.
I don't know the absolute answer. I would probably say as we've streamlined and improved our processes, account-based engagement is probably the smaller of the three. And inbound and outbound, a lot of our outbound activities are driven internally, you know, in terms of, you know, we have a marcoms team, we have a digital sort of marketing technologies team. So as a consequence, a lot of those activities tend to be, you know, a higher percentage of the activity. That said, there's a lot of sort of inbound activities that we do, you know, particularly around search engine optimization, where we're using third parties to help us, guide us on our Google AdWords strategy and things like that. So that tends to be a little bit less resource intensive, but money-wise, it's bigger. So because we're using a third party. So they're probably about 50-50 in terms of inbound and outbound, but account-based marketing is a much smaller percentage than the other two.
And you mentioned digital marketing technologists there. What kind of thing is that person responsible for? Is it actually your MarTech stack or is it digital marketing itself?
So there's an overlap, but we set up a marketing technologies team separate from our IT team. We felt within the marketing organization, we needed to have a greater understanding of those technologies. And that doesn't mean, you know, coding or understanding servers or all of that sort of important stuff that the IT provides in terms of infrastructure. But we needed to understand how the platform works, how a marketing automation suite worked. I didn't want the product marketing managers to be, for example, to be experts in drip campaigns and things like that. They need to understand what it is. They need to tell, you know, somebody what they're trying to achieve. But then I need somebody who's got, you know, deeper expertise to be able to sort of set that up within the marketing automation platform, as an example. Same with the website. You know, I can have the product marketing manager say, this is what I'm trying to achieve with that website. But somebody else who can create the template or the links or the way our content management system works to produce the pages of our website. They're the owners of the technology, if you like. They're the ones who understand the technology the best, and they can provide guidance as to what's possible and what's not, and also, you know, what's likely to work and what's not by understanding what best practice is in not just our industry, but, you know, the world at large.
And are they responsible for analytics and measurement as well, or is that a separate team?
Yeah, so good point. So we do actually have an analytics team within our marketing technologies group. They are responsible for all the analytics around those technology platforms. They also manage our SEO and SEM because that fitted well with them. The one exception is sales reporting. So we have a separate sales reporting group, which these two groups interact, obviously, but sales reporting we handle separately.
So your marketing function sounds pretty large, actually. Is it, would you say, larger than typical in our market?
Obviously, there are surveys out there like Gartner and things like that that highlight you know, the percentage of your total revenue that your marketing budget should be. We're on a par with that, certainly. What I would say is we definitely do more in-house versus contracting out. If you look at similar size companies and things like that, we do more in-house than the average company. I don't know whether that's just the scientific content and the needing to sort of understand that to be able to sort of translate it into marketing collateral, or whether it's just NEB being content heavy and, you know, that sort of science background that we have here. More of our costs are internal than contracted out. Some of these technologies perhaps being the exception to that.
So I'm going to change things up a little bit because we don't have very long left. We started to talk about failure and the culture of failure before, and I'm really interested to know, what's your biggest marketing or comms failure?
There's been lots. I don't mind admitting. Probably the one that sort of, I don't know, I remember most of it, or if you like, that I've never been able to get away from. one of the positions I had, we made the decision to sell an adjacent product family. So at the time, I was managing our drug screening portfolio, and we decided to move into the market of OEM in a series of combinatorial chemistry libraries. We weren't strong in chemistry or anything like that, but it was, you know, same customer base and all the rest of it. I took this one on myself to evaluate. I actually went out and met with, I don't know, probably half a dozen customers one-on-one, and was fairly convinced there was a market. So put together the financials and got approval to bring it in. And it started off well, but we ended up writing off, and I'm afraid I remember this quite well, about $92,000 worth of inventory, because basically, we couldn't sell it. To write that off was obviously, a painful experience. But it also, you know, led me to think about, why is it that I got this wrong? You know, I went out and talked to customers. I had all this market data. I did a good ROI analysis and all the rest of it. And I think the lesson I learned there was really that I didn't understand how customers were organized. So in this particular case, we were talking to the people who were using those libraries, not necessarily the groups who purchased them at the pharmaceutical companies. And that was a different group. So understanding, in this case, the buying process and the process by which customers consumed products, particularly in a large organization like a pharmaceutical company, I hadn't really appreciated that complexity. And I think the lesson there was really take time to understand your customers and ask, you know, even more detailed questions than you think you are, that go deeper beyond the product and the specifications and, as I said, how they use and, in this case, store and purchase that product.
Well, that brings us full circle to the start of our conversation about really understanding your target audience as a marketer. So it makes complete sense. On the other side, what's been your biggest marketing or comms success?
The things I enjoy most, I have to admit, is probably go back to my reasons I got into marketing, and that's launching new products. I really enjoy it because, you know, no one individual can launch a new product. It's a team effort. You've got, obviously, you know, scientists on the R&D side, you've got manufacturing staff, you've got commercial staff, et cetera, et cetera. And that team relationship of trying to work out how to be successful with a product is an awesome process. More recently, I think as well, and go back to my probably now overused example of having samples of products and being able to measure the consumption of an interest in those samples, which you can do digitally through, you know, forms on your website to have customers request for those. You can then set up, drip campaigns to obviously, follow up with the customer. You just received this sample. Here's the protocol. You just received this sample. Here's some application notes, checking in with them, and you can automate the whole thing. So some of those more recent product launches where we've been able to automate the touch points with the customer but keep them personal are some of the things I've really got a lot of enjoyment out of. There's still the scientific aspect of the development of the product, but now we're sort of using data to target the right customers, to look at their response rates to this product and the samples we're putting before them. It's just great. I mean, we've still got that attribution gap, but we've got many more leading indicators than we ever had before. So that would probably be my greatest enjoyment is around these new products and their automated delivery to the marketplace.
It gives you that immediate gratification, because before we used to send stuff out and it used to go into a bit of a black hole and then eventually somebody would buy. But being able to actually see the impact almost in real time, I get what you're saying. I get the same satisfaction. So
thank you for that.
So Andy, at the end of each podcast interview, we always ask a question posed by our previous interviewee. And my last person that I interviewed was the Vice President of Global Product Management and Market Development for the Pharma Services Group at Thermo Fisher, Hrissi Samartzadu. And I know that you know Hrissi well. Yep. So she has asked, how do you balance long-term and short-term strategies? She's really interested in hearing the perspective of you about how you stop getting distracted to make sure that both are seen through. What lessons have you learned, or if you're not achieving it, how do you plan to avoid these distractions?
It's a great question, and it definitely is a challenge, and certainly for me it's a challenge personally. I mean, I'm more of a planner, so as a consequence I like the planning process, but then I also like to check off all the boxes to say I did this, I did that, and those sorts of things. So your natural tendency is to focus on those shorter term objectives and shorter term goals, because you can cross them off quicker versus the longer term ones, which are harder. I think in today's world of need for instant gratification, as well as in a large public company that Hrissi is at, that return has got to be seen in a shorter time period as well. So it does make it a challenge. My experience, the only way to sort of truly address it, well, firstly, you have to get buy-in that some things are going to take longer than other things. And as a consequence, the time horizon is not next month, it's 6 months, it's 9 months, it's multiple years. And therefore, you have to develop ways of communicating differently, I think, for those longer term strategies to show you are making progress. It's not, thanks for your approval of this strategy, I'll see you in 3 years. You need to you need to continually show that things are making progress. Even small wins, I think, are important in that regard to say, how do we get to that objective? I think also if you can break that longer term strategy into bite-sized chunks so that, again, you can show progress to say, all right, the real return is in 3 years, but I met my 6 month milestone, I met my 9 month milestone, et cetera, I think is important. And the last one, I think, is really discipline. Go back to my example of checking the boxes and doing all the short-term tasks quickly. You have to set aside time in your day, in your week, your month to focus on these longer-term things and really do discipline and say, I don't know, Friday afternoon or whatever day of the week it is, this is my time to spend on the longer term strategies to continue to evolve and develop that that particular activity. Because if you don't, your calendar gets filled up and you're focusing on all just the short term. Maybe break it into shorter term activities that you can show and communicate progress against, and be disciplined with your time and energy to get the balance right between long and short.
I love that answer. And it's really interesting because I'm seeing that a lot as a trend with senior marketers who are starting to take 2 days out of their month, every month now, to look at the trends in the market, to start planning, to start looking forward and to actually take themselves out of any communications with their teams. And I think that's a learning that a lot of people have taken from COVID about needing that space and that time to be able to step out and think and act.
It's a great comment, Laura. I think that, as you highlighted, there are definitely learnings out of the pandemic that we have to make sure that we don't forget about, because everybody is now busy and we're going back to visit customers, we're going back on the road to trade shows and all the rest of it. And that time, that valuable time you had, particularly if you're working from home, when you have obviously less day-to-day or hour-to-hour distractions, shouldn't be lost. I mean, I've heard things like Think Thursday or whatever yes, sort of day of the week
exactly.
it is. And how do you build those in and keep that part of your week free for these sorts of longer term thinking and discussion?
Exactly. So, Andy, I'm going to ask you the same thing. Do you have a question for our next interviewee?
Yeah, happy to. I haven't delved into this much in our discussion, but I'm a great believer that the customer experience is the true differentiator for any company. Marketing obviously plays an important role in the evolution and development of that customer experience. So the question is, within the life sciences, what are the next sort of major advances that we're going to see in the customer experience, either driven by companies like ourselves or driven by customers seeing those experiences in other industries?
I love that question. I'm really excited for the answer because you've probably been seeing companies are hiring marketers from outside of the scientific realm, bringing people from, you know, Fortune 100 companies. So I think we're going to increasingly see some very different approaches to that. So I'm intrigued to hear the answer.
Yeah, I agree totally.
So Andy, thank you so much for your time today. It's been an absolute pleasure. Is there anything that we haven't discussed that you'd like to bring up at all?
No, we've covered a great number of topics. It's great to catch up with you, number one, but also have the opportunity to discuss all these different topics, a theme, obviously, of data running through them and the importance of data. And as I said earlier on, I truly believe that marketing is a mix of art and science. We focus more on the science in this discussion. And being in the life sciences, that scientific component is as important today as it ever has been.
Couldn't agree more, and what a perfect way to end our discussion. Andy, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
My pleasure too. Great talking.